This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest today is in the minority. I don't say that because she's an Asian woman in science, although she is. No, I say that because while many people run screaming from spiders, she turns to them for inspiration. She's also one of the few whose work has been considered so groundbreaking that it earned her a so-called genius grant. Cheryl Hayashi is a 2007 MacArthur Fellow, currently professor and vice chair of biology at UC Riverside, where she studies the evolution and biomechanics of spider silk. She joins me now in our Woods Hole studio. Cheryl Hayashi, welcome to Living Lab.
Oh, thank you.
Have you always loved spiders?
Well, I think I never went through a period of disliking them, but I'd say honestly, I didn't pay that much attention to them until I was in college. And it was really an undergraduate research opportunity that led me to just start looking up close and personal at spiders. And once I started looking at them and, you know, just finding out how fascinating they are, I was just hooked.
Do you have a favorite?
Oh, that's a tough question. I mean, that's like asking a mother to choose amongst her kids as to who's her favorite. That's really cruel to ask me. You know, it's always, you know, the spider that I'm currently working on or, you know, just worked on, that's always kind of forefront in my mind. But it's really hard to pick a favorite. But in terms of just, you know, looking at spiders, it's hard not to like jumping spiders. They're absolutely adorable and cute. I challenge anyone to disagree with that.
We will have to put a picture of a jumping spider on our website and see if we can actually get some arachnophobes to convert.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've shown pictures of jumping spiders to arachnophobes, and they've said almost like a teddy bear.
Really?
Yeah.
Are there any spiders that do scare you?
Oh, I definitely have a healthy respect for spiders. You always have to know which end is up when you work with them.
That's one way of putting it. So how do you pick which spiders you study?
Well, I pick them for a variety of reasons. One is just practicality. So living in Southern California, I like to work on spiders that are, you know, easy for us to get, easy for us to take students out to look for, you know, even outside of our biology building. So I do work on local spiders there. I also, for the kind of work I do, I need to have a lot of the same spider. So I don't want to work on something that's very hard to even find a single individual. So it has to be fairly common. I also choose spiders by, you know, sort of where they are in the family tree of spiders. So really trying to get at diversity, as well as just, you know, practical reasons of, you know, can I get them locally? But the ones I can't get locally, I will either travel to get them or I'll work with colleagues or, you know, even commercial suppliers to get a hold of them.
Where is the strangest, most remote place you've ever traveled to get a spider for research?
Oh, let's see. To get a spider for research. Well, when I was a graduate student, you know, I went to Central America to work on spiders. And I don't think it's strange and remote. But, you know, when I was a graduate student at Yale University and also the American Museum of Natural History. And, you know, coming from the Northeast, going into the rainforests of Costa Rica and Panama, that's pretty exotic.
Are there certain spiders that are more frequently the subject of research than other spiders?
Yes. So first of all, definitely female spiders are much, much, much better studied than male spiders.
Why?
So female spiders tend to be larger. They also have many more kinds of silks that they produce because female spiders have to make egg sacs. And so they have to have that an egg sac producing silk glands. They use copious amount of silks to make egg sacs. Female spiders also need a lot of silk just because they have to keep catching food to eat so they can, you know, make eggs. While male spiders, once they become sexually mature, they use some silk, but not nearly as much as a female spider. And also in terms of sort of taxonomy species, spiders that make orb webs, so those sort of, you know, wagon wheel webs that have radii and a spiral going over it, those kinds of spiders are much better studied.
You didn't always study spiders. I mean, you said you first encountered spider research as an undergraduate, but some of your early publications are on arthropods, close, antelopes, whales. What was that about, and how did you transition into looking at spiders specifically?
Well, I'm generally interested in evolution of life And so all my work is going to have something to do with the evolution of life. And it might not necessarily be on spiders, but it's always trying to figure out, you know, how did life evolve? And we don't have a time machine. So it's trying to figure out, you know, how we can use information from organisms that live today or even from the fossil record to try to piece together exactly the sequence of events that led to what we see today. And so, you know, the vast majority of my work has centered on spiders. And, you know, I'm just, there's just keep more questions keep coming up. So I'll never finish.
Excuse my ignorance, but is the field of spider silk research a big one?
It's a growing field, I'm very, very happy to report. So there's always been people, you know, interested in spider silk. But, you know, a lot of some recent developments that happened, you know, it's, I think it's really snowballing. And so a lot more people are interested in spider silk, especially as we're now getting into how we can use silk for biotechnology. But, you know, if you work on spiders for any amount of time, it's very hard not to notice that they produce this absolutely amazing, amazing fibers from their bodies. And so, you know, if you go back in the historical literature, you'll see that, you know, just people, everyone was fascinated by spider silk. You know, if you spend any time at all with spiders, even people that, for instance, study birds, the hummingbirds, people that work on hummingbirds have noticed that the hummingbirds collect spider silk and they weave it into their nests. So, you know, it's not just a small club of us.
In case you're just joining us, I'm talking with spider biologist Cheryl Hayashi of UC Riverside. Cheryl, is there a formal definition for silk?
There's not a formal scientific definition. There's sort of a general definition, which is it's a, you know, generally proteins made by an organism that are enriched in some particular amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins. And generally, it's just, you know, fibrous secretions that, you know, come out of generally an arthropod. But there are some worm type organisms that also make silks. So it's generally, it's just a sort of a classification. It's just a category of a kind of secretion.
And how many animals, in addition to spiders, you know, there's also silkworms, how many animals make silk?
Oh, silk has evolved numerous times in the history of life. So besides spiders, people know silkworms, but silk is hypothesized to have evolved over 20 times independently just among insect orders.
So, and yet it always comes to this similar conclusion of being some of the same proteins, some of the same amino acids that make up the silk protein.
Well, as silk biologists, characterize more and more kinds of silks, we're finding that there's more variety than people knew before. But, you know, it does seem there are some general themes. So, you know, they do seem to silk does always seem to be made up of, you know, repeating building blocks, and that these repeats, you know, just continue on and on and on. But there, you know, as more and more types of silks are examined, we're finding that there's a lot more ways to make silk than, you know, people initially imagined. But that's not surprising, right? As research goes on, you hope to find all these, you know, how many different ways that, you know, have evolved to make silk.
I was really surprised to learn, I'm a beekeeper at home, relatively new to it, but I was really surprised to learn that bees make silk. I mean, we all know they make honey and wax, and that's great, but they also make silk.
Yes, bees make silk, wasps make silk, there's ants that make silk. So silk is, yeah, a lot of organisms make silk. So basically, you know, anytime that there would be a need for something fibrous to either cover themselves. So with insects, it's often to cover the pupal stage, or, you know, just a larval stage that's going through a vulnerable period. They'll often cover their bodies with silk. For Hymenoptera, so with, you know, they often need to have silk also.
Are the Hymenoptera?
So those are the bees, wasps, and ants. Yeah. So they often, quite a few of them are able to make silks, and they, you know, incorporate them in some ways into their nests and things like that.
And what are the other ways? I mean, so spiders, of course, spider webs. And then you've mentioned egg sacs and covering the larvae. Are those basically the uses of silk, or are there other uses?
Oh, there's other uses of silk. So, you know, silk can be used to tether an organism to a spot. Silks could be used to, there's, you know, sort of silk-like proteins that are also used to put like a little stalk for an egg So there's all kinds of applications of silk like that.
And are those all the same kind of silk for all those different applications?
It turns out that they're all sort of, you know, slightly different from each other. And that's sort of where the silk gets fascinating. So, you know, if silk is used for different purposes, there's usually something a little different about, you know, how they're constructed, how they're made. And that's where a lot of the thinking about, you know, how silk might be used, how we might, as you know, apply the knowledge from silk to our human applications. If you go out in nature and find some organisms that's using silk in an unusual way, that might figure out, oh, that could be something that, you know, maybe humans could use. So if you find a silk, for instance, that's used in an aquatic environment, like, oh, maybe that could be used, you know, underwater. Or if you have a silk that's used at high altitude, oh, maybe that's something that could be used there. So all these, you know, Mother Nature has just come up with a lot of solutions for all kinds of environmental challenges.
You've actually done evolutionary studies looking at the molecular level, at these amino acid building blocks, how different spider silks are related to each other, how they might have evolved from one another. What do you get out of that, other than just, I mean, you now know how they evolved for the relationships between them, but what else does that give you? What can you do with that kind of information?
Oh, there's a lot we can do with that. So first of all, I don't feel like, you know, at this point, I'm working on how the silks have evolved, but we have a very incomplete picture. So there's still a lot we don't know about how spider silks have evolved. So, you know, we're gaining sort of, you know, how the different silks are related to each other. So, you know, which silks are more similar, which silks might have evolved later. We're trying to figure out, you know, how you have different families of spiders, different types of spiders, and exactly what silks they can make and, you know, how did that come to be. So we're learning that. And by studying this, we also can just learn something about how these genes, so silk is a protein, that means there's a gene for those silks, how those genes evolve. And that could have that has a lot of potential in terms of wanting to use silk in for human applications. So with the genes, you know, we can figure out what's the design rules? What are the design rules for making a silk? And if we look to see in nature, well, how do those genes change? How do they mutate over time? That might give us either, you know, ideas or perhaps some warnings about things we might want to be careful about as we use silk genes.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is spider biologist and spider silk researcher, Cheryl Hayashi. We'll talk more about the magnificence of spider silk when Living Lab continues after a short break. This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with biologist Cheryl Hayashi of UC Riverside. In 2007, she won a MacArthur Fellowship, the so-called Genius Grants, for her work on spider silk. In 2010, she gave a TED Talk on the magnificence of spider silk. You can find that video on our website. Cheryl Hayashi, what makes spider silk so magnificent?
What makes it so magnificent? Oh, I'd say, first of all, it's just the sheer diversity of silks. And like a lot of organisms make silks, but what makes spiders really, really special is that if you could just take one individual spider, so you could take, you know, let's say Charlotte from Charlotte's Web. If you just take Charlotte, you could spend a lifetime just studying the silks Charlotte can make, because she makes 7 kinds of silks. And each of those silks, you know, it's a puzzle to unravel exactly, you know, how they're constructed, how do they work, what their properties are, why are they important to that spider. So you could spend a lifetime just studying Charlotte's Web, literally. And then what's also amazing about the silks is it's not just how absolutely essential they are for spiders themselves, but just over evolutionary time, how these mechanical properties, so, you know, how strong, how stretchy, how stiff a silk is, they've all seemed to have been so carefully fine-tuned over hundreds of millions of years of evolution. And it's just mind-blowing to see that much experimentation and tinkering go on there. And so the properties of silks are just phenomenal. So there are some spider silks that, you know, rival the strength of steel. Certainly by weight. Yet, I mean, try to weigh any spider silk. I mean, they weigh nothing. But yet, you know, you see them suspended in midair. They're catching flying insects. They're supporting the weight of the spider. And that's absolutely amazing to me. They're also holding up to the rain. You know, they don't just get washed away. And silk endures over long periods of times. I mean, you know, you have some spiders, for instance, trapdoor spiders. They live in burrows in the ground, and the burrows are lined with silk. And a spider will spend their entire life in that burrow. So the silk, you know, those spiders will reinforce it during their lifetime. But we're talking about silk that might is you know, has to last and function for years, maybe 5, 10, 15 years. I mean, that's an incredible material.
Why do they line their burrow with silk? Why can't they just live in a dirt burrow?
Well, the lining probably has to do with supporting the structure so that the burrow is unlikely to cave in on them. So, you know, as just sort of, you know, as in terms of, you don't want the soil, you know, falling into the burrow and, you know, covering up the spider and has spider to dig out. Or they also, a female spider will also have her hold her egg sac down in the burrow. So you definitely don't want the burrow just filling up with dirt. The silk lining of burrow also has some sensory applications. So the silk lines towards the top of a burrow, there'll be lines that also sort of radiate out of the burrow, you know, onto the ground. And it's just sort of like a little, you know, antenna that a spider can use to help them sense, you know, whether or not prey might be walking by, or perhaps something, a predator walking by. And so they would, you either jump out or you might hunker down.
Fascinating. Now, you said, you know, there's 40,000 different kinds of spiders, and then a lot of them making 7 different types of silks. Why do they need 7 different types? Why can't they just use one kind of silk for the different applications?
Well, it does seem that for some spiders don't seem to have as many kinds of silks. And so those kinds of spiders I think of, you know, they have a sort of a general purpose silk. You know, they have to, it's like the duct tape, you know, like they'll find many, many uses. They have like one roll of duct tape and they'll do all sorts of things with it. And that works for them. But there's other spiders that have these very fine tuned applications. And it seems, you know, clearly over the course of evolution, the silks have changed. Spiders have evolved multiple kinds of silks, and the silks have diverged or changed from each other to be very specialized for a particular purpose. So, for instance, there's a silk that's specialized, you know, to be strong and moderately stretchy. There's another silk that's less strong but extremely stretchy, and these all work differently. So, for instance, you know, if you want to think about, you know, fibers, this, have a little, you know, mind experiment. Think about a tennis racket and you're playing tennis, okay? What happens when, you know, you hit a tennis ball with your tennis racket? A tennis racket is very stiff. The ball, you know, should sort of just rebound off the racket. But what happens when the ball goes into the net? The net is stretchier. The net absorbs the energy of the ball and the ball falls to the court. So, you know, in one case, the ball, you know, if it hits your tennis racket, it'll zoom right back across the net. But if you hit it into the net actually absorbs that energy and you just, you know, you see the ball fall to the ground. So in the same way, you know, it depends on what a spider is doing with their web. So there are webs that are really, you know, seem to be designed for insects kind of hit it and then an insect would fall down and a spider might be waiting on the bottom. So the spider might be patrolling under a web. And yet there's other webs that are aerial orb webs that are really actually flying snares. And so an insect has to get into the web and actually get held there. And that would be more like, you know, an insect would actually have to get caught in the web. So it all depends on the purpose for it. And also, you know, there's a silk to wrap up an insect. That silk functions very differently from a silk that a spider has to dangle from.
Right. I mean, you don't want a super stretchy wrapping, I guess.
Right. And so it all seems to be, you know, very fine-tuned that way. And there's, you know, we're still trying to understand sort of, you know, why all the silks are the way, you know, exactly how each type of silk functions. But there's probably something to have to do with, you know, how quickly a fiber has to be formed, you know, how much of that fiber is needed. So all that goes into this, you know, puzzle. But it's amazing how many kinds of silks there are. And it does seem very essential for certain kinds of spiders to have this whole variety. A lot of ways I think about this is, you know, if you're building a house, you're going to use different materials for the different parts of your house. The frame of your house is going to be different from the siding of your house, for instance. And it's all different materials and all have different properties.
What is the strongest spider silk that we know of to date?
Well, one of the strongest spider silks is a is a dragline silk that's spun by what's called the Darwin's bark spider. So it's a spider that's found in Madagascar, and it's a very large orb web weaving spider that builds a gorgeous orb web over streams. And it's a big spider, and it catches, you know, big juicy prey. And
when
so
you
that's,
say big, what are we talking?
You know, like your little, like your some size of your thumb, or a little bigger than that.
Okay. Yeah. That's respectable.
Yeah. It's a respectable size. But that seems to be one of our strongest and toughest silks out there.
And how strong is it?
Oh, it's certainly, you know, by weight, it certainly rivals steel. In terms of toughness, it's far tougher.
What's the difference between strength and toughness?
So strength is, you know, the amount of force it takes to actually break the fiber, while toughness is a combination of properties where it incorporates, you know, the strength, also how extensible a fiber is. So toughness is this composite measure that reflects how much energy can be absorbed by a material before it fails. And so for silk, because silks are both strong and also stretchy, that's why they're super, super tough. And you contrast that with something like wood, for instance. So wood is strong, but it's generally not very stretchy. And so wood, you know, it's very strong, but, you know, it can't absorb as much energy, for instance, as silk can. Silk is more extensible. Sometimes people might not want that extensibility because for some applications, you know, because silk is absorbing so much energy by stretching, that might not work for some applications. But for a web, it works.
Right. How do you measure those kinds of properties of spider silk in the web? Are you pulling apart webs and I don't know, putting them in some sort of pincers and pulling on them? How do you actually measure this?
That's exactly how we do it. So first of all, you know, it was noticed pretty early on that, you know, you could just basically poke. If you just see a web in your garden, you can just poke at it and you can see that different parts of the web have different, they react differently to you poking at it. And I often have people comment to me that, you know, when they see black widow webs, they like to pluck at them. Because they seem so strong, and so people pluck at those webs. You know, I don't know if a lot of listeners out there go out and do that now, just go out and, you know, try to play a tune on different kinds of spider webs. But if you just start poking at webs, you'll easily notice that, you know, it's very obvious that the silks are different. There's something different about them. And so, but you want to measure them carefully in the lab. So what we do in the lab is we collect silk from a spider. We might either take silk from a web the spider built. So, you know, we would have a spider build a web in the lab, and we would collect little bits of silk onto little cards, or we would actually put a spider under a microscope and we would carefully, you know, pull silk fibers out of the spider. So we would actually, you know, pull it out of the spider, and then we would put it onto a little card, and then we would put it in a machine with little clamps, and basically you just stretch the fiber, and you can stretch it. And as you're stretching it, you know, you can measure exactly how much the fiber is resisting stretching, and you can also figure out how far the silk stretched. And that's how we can get careful measurements. We also want to measure exactly how thick, so the diameter of a silk fiber, because it really, you know, you want to have a fair measurement. So some spiders are bigger than other spiders, and a bigger spider tends to make thicker silk. So you want to always correct, you know, your measurements. You want to normalize it for how much material you're testing. You know, is it like a big fat licorice, or is it like shoestring licorice? You want to know what the diameter is.
Right. I mean, a thicker rope is always going to be, well, not always, but same material, thicker rope would be stronger.
Yes. But you want to, well, so that, yeah, that at that absolute level, but you want to know, okay, but for that material, you know, if you scale it up or down, how does, you want to have a common sort of a common currency to compare.
Based on the measurements that you have made and your understanding of the evolution and the building blocks of these silks, are we at a point where we can start to tease apart the recipe for a strong silk or a stretchy silk or a tough silk, these different properties?
Oh, yes, we certainly are at that point. So work done by my lab and also just some labs, you know, in the United States and around the world have really worked on, you know, elucidating what these different building blocks are for silks that are stretchy and silks that are stronger. And now, you know, we can actually test our hypotheses about that. You know, we could actually make silks. You can actually make silks, sort of engineer them and, you know, make basically man-made spider silk. And you could see, you know, well, I think these are the strengthening parts. If I add more of these strengthening parts, you know, do I actually get a stronger silk? And we can actually do experiments like that. And that's going on. And so it's kind of exciting. So we have this great natural diversity, and we can also tailor it for, you know, some application that we might have that perhaps spiders, you know, didn't have a need to meet that challenge.
You're listening to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. I'm talking with Cheryl Hayashi about her research on spider silk. So you're saying we can actually synthetically make spider silk at this point?
Yes. So there's quite a bit of research going on in that area. So spiders themselves are problematic to use for sort of large-scale production of spider silk. Sort of one problem is most spiders make so many kinds of silk that you'd sort of have a purity concern. So let's say, you know, I'm going to sell someone, let's say, you know, or be a provider for someone of dragline silk. It's pretty time consuming to do the quality control to make sure that I'm collecting only dragline silk from an animal that can make 7 kinds of silk. Like, how do you ever be sure from these tiny, tiny little body parts that I'm only collecting dragline silk? And then there's the, you know, other problem of just, I mean, you know, even a spider that's the size of your thumb or larger, even a spider, you know, that's considered large in spider world is pretty small in terms of, you know, producing a lot of silk fiber. They won't produce more than, you know, you're lucky if you get, you know, 100 meters from one spider at one silking session. But, you know, generally for a research purpose or a, you know, it just even thinks about, you know, you want to make a textile or something from silk, you have to have a mass produced silk. And so for that reason, there's research that's being done where basically you're making silk in some host organism that's a lot easier to raise in mass quantity. So you could put silk into plants like tobacco or alfalfa. You could put spider silk genes into silkworms, the domesticated silkworm. And so that's pretty cool. So now the silkworm is making spider silk, but also has the machinery to make the silk. And there's a lot of work done on putting silk into microbes, so bacteria, and just, you know, basically having them being made in a test tube.
All right, let's break this down. So if you're genetically modifying a silkworm to make spider silk instead of worm silk.
Right, you're adding a spider silk gene.
But they essentially have the same machinery to make the fibers?
So it's an analogous. So silkworms independently evolve making silk, and silkworms make their silk comes out of their mouth. Well, for spiders, it comes out of the rear end of their abdomen. So on spiders, the spinnerets are on their abdomen, the back part of their abdomen.
And all the different kinds of silk come out of one set of spinnerets?
Spiders have multiple pairs of spinnerets. So primitively, spiders had 4 pairs of spinnerets. And now there's no living spider nowadays that has all 4 pairs. So depending on which spider you look at, you know, they've lost some of those pairs.
And so, how do we know that they used to have them? Is that from fossils?
From fossils. You can also look at sort of, you know, some of it is recorded in the development of little, you know, embryonic spiders. You can kind of see that they could see rudiments that, you know, that there's this four, you know, there used to be 4 pairs, but you can see it from the fossil record. And also it's just by comparative biology. So if you look at spiders today, you can see that, you know, it's different combinations of the original 4 pairs have been preserved in different families of spiders. So that's how you can, you know, sort of you trace back the puzzle and you say, oh, well, that must have started off with 4 in order to see the diversity we have today. That would be the easiest hypothesis that you'd come up with. And so, yeah, this ground plan of, you know, having 4 pairs of things, that's kind of seems like kind of common to spiders, you know, the 4 pairs of legs, you know,
right.
And so it's kind of not surprising that way. So a spider can make many kinds. They have, you know, multiple spinnerets, and they have many, you know, dozens to hundreds to thousands of silk glands in their abdomen. Well, for a silkworm, the domesticated silkworm, the kind of silkworm that makes, you know, your silk blouse, for instance, has only 1 pair of silk glands, and they're modified salivary glands, so they're in their mouth region.
When a silkworm makes spider silk proteins, does it come out equally strong and the same structure?
So that hasn't been shown to be, you know, we believe that's going to be the case, but that kind of work is still, it's still in progress. The work that has been published on that by another group showed that it was a mixture of both the silkworm silk plus the spider silk. It was a mixture of that one, and it did have properties that were intermediate between silkworm silk and, you know, sort of the bona fide, the real McCoy spider silk. But actually having, you know, a silkworm that makes 100% spider silk, that work is still in progress, and I haven't seen a paper on that one yet.
What about,
I'm sure it's coming.
What about the bacterial production of spider silk? How does that work?
So with the bacterial production, a silk gene is, you know, added to a lab bacteria, and it's bacteria that, and the bacteria is grown, you know, in liquid nutrients, and they're, you know, the bacteria are completely pampered to try to encourage them to make, you know, as much protein as possible. So they're given, you know, whatever temperature, whatever, you know, whatever nutrients are just absolutely best for that bacteria. You know, they're completely pampered and babied, and, you know, into making as much protein as possible. And then the silk protein is purified from, you know, after the bacteria is allowed to make protein, and then the silk protein is purified away from the rest of the bacteria and all everything else that's in that, you know, sort of the soup.
That gets you a pile, essentially, of silk protein. But how does that get you to a silk fiber?
Okay, so whether or not, you know, you're making silk proteins in a plant, or if it's being made in bacteria, or there's even silk proteins that are made in goat's milk.
Really?
There's goats at Utah State that have silk spider silk genes added to them, and yeah, the silk comes out. It's expressed in this mammary glands, so it comes out in the milk. And after the silk is separated away from the rest of the goat's milk, yeah, you have just a pile of proteins, but it's certainly not a silk fiber. So the next step would be to dissolve the silk proteins make it a liquid goo, and then it goes through an artificial spinning process that, you know, basically your silk is it's like a mixture of these silk molecules, you know, many, 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 many silk molecules inside that are dissolved in liquid. And when you make a fiber, basically you have to interlock the molecules together and remove the water. And that's how you get a dry fiber of interlocked silk molecules. And that's what a fiber is, a silk fiber.
I mean, can you essentially put the silk protein into a syringe or something and squeeze it out? Or what does that process look like?
You could make a very crude fiber by doing something like that with a syringe and just basically, you know, shooting it out of like a narrow little opening. You could get a silk fiber that way. But it turns out you don't get a very high quality fiber that way. So the way I've seen it done and what's in the literature is you have your liquid goo, and it'll typically go through, you know, you start the fiber, you make a fiber, and then you'll wet it into some other kind of liquid, some other solvent, and then you would stretch it a second time. And all of this is controlled in terms of, you know, how quickly a fiber is drawn from the liquid goo. So a lot of the way that's sort of, you know, artificial man-made spider silk is made, some of the procedures they're doing look a little bit like when people are spinning like polyester, you know, out of chemical compounds. There's some of it that looks a little analogous.
And I took an organic chemistry class in high school where we made, I think it was nylon, and basically just had a beaker of the liquid chemical and had a little tiny metal hook that we dipped in and kind of pulled it out and spun it around in our finger.
That is the start of spinning artificial silk. You have your little beaker with your dissolved silk proteins in it, and basically, yep, you put a little, you want to hook out a little starter, and then put that on like a little bobbin, and then you can start reeling it, and then it'll go through various processing. And it's kind of amazing because people have been great strides have been made, and people have been working on this, and the equipment to do this is really complicated. And that brings me back to the spider. You see the spider, maybe you don't even want the spider in your yard or in your garage or in your windowsill, and when you see that spider make silk, it's doing something that is, you know, humans are racking their brains trying to replicate. That very simple process of a spider, when you see a spider just, you know, coming down from the eave of your roof, you know, and coming down from your roof, going past your window.
Seems just, so effortless.
It's completely effortless. And just think about, okay, copy that.
That's Cheryl Hayashi of UC Riverside. I'm Heather Goldstone. We'll talk more about why we might go to all the effort of making spider silk when Living Lab continues in just a moment. Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guest is spider silk researcher Cheryl Hayashi. She's professor and vice chair of biology at UC Riverside. So, Cheryl, the question here is, why go to all the effort of making synthetic spider silk? What would we do with it if we had it?
There's just so much potential that could be used with synthetic spider silk. So, for one thing, you know, it's incredibly strong and tough for its weight. So for any application where, you know, you would value having something that was lightweight and strong, for any application like that, spider silk could be a part of it. So for instance, if you want to have lightweight, you know, it could be part of a composite material that could go into, for instance, airplane parts or automobile parts. So any application where, you know, having something very durable and strengthening, but not adding to weight, and that would increase fuel efficiency.
So not necessarily something that is a fiber, not necessarily just a rope or, you know, cloth made out of fiber, but actually like molded shaped parts.
It could be fibers within a shaped part. So a lot of composite materials, think about it as a mesh, and then there would be, you know, some sort of other material, you know, filling in the mesh. So it could be that you could make spider silk into a film. You could make it into a thin film that, you know, that has a lot of these properties that, you know, the silk fibers have. But you might cast it into some sort of other form that, you know, maybe spiders don't do, but you could sort of, you know, harness those proteins and shape them for your own purpose. So taking advantage of their lightweight and their sort of their strength and stretchiness, toughness, that could come into be very useful. Other applications could make use of the observation that spider silk doesn't elicit an immune response in mammals. So
really?
That makes it biocompatible. So it could be, again, you know, it would be something that, you know, you could think of. It could be a bandage. It could be incorporated into something that we could implant into people. It could be used for some sort of drug delivery application.
Do we know why it doesn't elicit an immune response? I mean, it's a protein created by another animal. Shouldn't that trigger an immune response?
Well, immune responses, you know, really have to do with sort of the shapes of proteins. I mean, you know, a lot of our immune system, you know, works to actually sort of, you know, match the shapes of, you know, invading foreign particles in our body. And there just seems to be something about, you know, I wouldn't say this is necessarily true for all spider silks, but certainly some of them seem to just have a very, you know, benign shape that doesn't, it's not recognized as something, you know, foreign and bad to get rid of. So it doesn't have that effect. So, you know, you could think of a lot of sort of, you know, therapeutic applications of that. Then there's also some other properties of silk, you know, having something that's just very strong and very fine, you know, you could think of as, you know, electronics are getting smaller and smaller. There could be some really great applications there. There's also just, you know, well, maybe other people don't do this, but I do it on a regular basis, just looking at the beauty of spider silk. And it's how absolutely, you know, it has a wonderful sheen. Some of it's even colored.
Really?
We don't fully understand how that works. That hasn't been replicated yet, but there are naturally colored silks out there. And I just think, you know, that this also, you know, I could see it being, you know, used for, you know, it's just for its beauty. There could be, you know, applications where people want something just for its aesthetics, whether it's for art or for a new kind of textile, just a new material.
I want to ask you about a few specific ideas for how we might use spider silk. One I saw was biodegradable fishing lines. Now, you mentioned that the silk is actually quite durable.
Yes.
How quickly would it degrade, and do we have any understanding of how it might hold up in water as opposed to in the air where most of the spider webs actually are?
So silk is very durable. So during a spider's lifetime, the silk is very durable. But silk is also, it's made of protein. And so, in fact, many spiders eat their silks. They digest their silk. So it's made of protein. So it's basically, you know, expensive for them to make.
Right.
So when they're, you know, if a web gets a lot of damage, many spiders will basically, what we call it, taking down their web. They'll actually bite through the frame of their web, and the web will just collapse into, you know, a little ball, and they'll actually gather it up and they'll eat it.
Perfect then, recycling.
Absolutely, yes. You know, talk about, you know, they repurpose it. they reuse and repurpose their silks. And so so clearly, you know, and that's a very natural process. And also just being, you know, spider webs on the environment, you know, they will eventually degrade. And that's unlike fishing line. So fishing line doesn't naturally degrade. And there's a lot of other materials that also just don't naturally degrade. For instance, like Kevlar. So that's, you know, a very high performance man-made fiber. It doesn't degrade. And typically, if you want to get rid of it, you must incinerate it. And so even with fishing line, you know, fishing line is either just when it's disposed of, you know, it goes into a landfill or it has to be incinerated.
And a lot of it ends up lost in the ocean.
A lot of it just ends up lost. Yes, just lost in oceans and streams. And, you know, that's definitely a problem. I mean, if you think about, you know, fishing lines in the ocean, the fishing lines are made so well that, you know, all the fishing line that's been made and lost in the ocean, it's still there. And so if we could have a fishing line that, you know, was made of proteins, you'd want it to last long enough while you were fishing. But if you were to lose it, it would eventually degrade. It's sort of like now they have those, you know, degradable garbage bags that, you know, it's going to hold up while you need it, but it'll eventually disintegrate.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around just how strong spider silk is and the idea that silk might be able to be used as body armor. Could we literally make a cloth that could be bulletproof?
You could, yes. I mean, you literally could. So you'd need a lot of silk to do that. The way I envision it is that I think the silk would be part of body armor. So even, I mean, body armor that people use today is not just made of a single material. I mean, it's multiple elements coming together to make the body armor. But easily I could see, you know, silk could be incorporated into body armor. And silk is so much lighter in weight, and it's also flexible. So, you know, you might be able to cover parts of the body that are now maybe more difficult to cover, you know, like over joints. And being lighter weight, that has some advantages in terms of, you know, everything else that, you know, a soldier or law enforcement has to, you know, carry with them. Or if you're in if they have to carry a lot of gear with them. So certainly spider silk could be part of that. Some of the silks, I think, that have been talked about in terms of body armor, you know, I think you wouldn't really want it to be 100% silk, because silk is also, these silks are that are very tough are strong, but they're also extensible. So that would mean that, you know, you have something impacts the body armor, but if you have a very extensible material, it might stop a particle, but that particle might be partially in you.
Because the tennis net as opposed to the tennis racket.
Yeah, yeah. Whether you want it, you know, to just ricochet off of you, or whether you want some of that energy absorbed. It'll be absorbed by, let's say, a bulletproof vest. But if that vest actually stretches too much, that would be... This is why you wouldn't want it. I don't think you want it 100% spider silk. But I think, you know, the design principles of spider silk could certainly come into play for things like bulletproof vests. For certain kinds of, you know, armor, you know, I think, yeah, the silk could be definitely be of use there. I know it is kind of hard to wrap your mind around that silk being strong. And a lot of people, you know, have asked me, they said, how could silk be strong when I can easily sort of, you know, just do a karate chop and knock a web down?
You can swipe your hand through a web.
And... Exactly. And the way I try to explain this is, well, you know, you have to think about how much material is there. And I'm not saying that, like, literally you would just, like, wear a spider web and that would protect you, you know? It'd be very immodest, too.
You'd have to have a lot more of it.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like the difference between ripping one page of a telephone book versus trying to rip the whole phone book. It's really easy to rip one page of the phone book, you know, but try to rip a whole phone book, you know, and that becomes like, you know, a party trick, right?
Yeah,
you know,
it's almost impossible.
Yeah.
If we could make synthetic spider silk, could we make Spider-Man?
Oh, could you make Spider-Man?
Could you do Spider-Man? Could you do the whole, you know, suit with the hand that shoots webs and have it be strong enough that could actually hold a human being?
I think what we would have to kind of work on the spinning technology, because as we were discussing earlier, when spider silk proteins are made, for instance, by bacteria or a plant or a goat, what you end up is, you know, just these pile of proteins, and then you have to go through that spinning process, just like your high school class and making nylon. And that did not involve shooting the silk, right, at the wall, you know, and then hanging from it.
I'm sure my teacher was very glad that was not involved, yes.
So, I think we'd have to work on that kind of spinning, you know, a sort of projectile spinning. But the idea that you could have silk fibers that, you know, could be formed very quickly and then deployed, I mean, that does seem like, yeah, why not? Definitely possible. I mean, what Spider-Man is capturing when he shoots those fibers, you know, out of his wrists is how quickly a spider can make their silk. So inside a spider's body, the silk is liquid. But yet outside the body, it's a fiber. And that transformation from a liquid to a solid is taking place almost instantaneously when you watch a spider, you know, drop from its web or actually spin a web. You're seeing in real time, you're just seeing a fiber being spun out of liquid silk. And that's just amazing. I mean, there aren't other proteins that are formed and usable instantaneously.
Your research has been expanding not only to cover spiders and spider silks, but silks made by other animals, and also even glues and adhesives made in the natural world. Are you moving more in this kind of applied materials science direction, do you think?
I'm interested in sort of understanding all aspects of whatever biological system I'm studying. And so I wouldn't say that my heart is definitely, you know, as an evolutionary biologist, it's just the way, you know, I view the world around me. And so I definitely, you know, will always be asking evolutionary questions. But when you start asking these evolutionary questions and you work on something like spiders, you know, you start thinking about, well, you know, what could this be used for? And sometimes thinking about what it could be used for, it actually does benefit your research on trying to understand spiders. So all the work that's being done to try to make, you know, artificial spider silks, I feel that that really helps also inform. You could, you know, think about, as humans experiment with spider silk recipes, you could start thinking about, well, you know, does this give us some insights into what might have been happening as, you know, over evolutionary time, sort of spiders were experimenting with their silk recipes? You know, what could be going on there? You know, and what are the different challenges? So when you take a spider silk and you want to make it in some, you know, new kind of host, you know, you just start thinking about, wow, what happened during the course of spider evolution when you had spiders moving into new environments, you know, going up in trees or burrowing? Exactly what happened there? So for me, it's all sort of integrated into research. And so for me, I think, you know, my research puzzle gets bigger, and sometimes I go out a little more on one, you know, limb or branch of it than the others. But I don't think I'll ever really stray from thinking about the spider, because that's where the inspiration always comes from. It always comes from thinking about this an organism and what an organism is doing, how it got there, and then, wow, that's cool. What can we do with it? But I'll always be grounded in an organism.
That's Cheryl Hayashi, professor and vice chair of biology at UC Riverside and a 2007 MacArthur Fellow. Cheryl, thank you and good luck.
Oh, thank you.
You can read more about spider silk research and watch Cheryl Hayashi's TED Talk on the magnificence of spider silk on our website, capeandislands.org. Until next week, this is Living Lab. You can always find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.